Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Catherine Neville, who reads from and discusses her new book, The Fire, published by Ballantine. In the weeks to come, we have Peter Greenberg, Wally Lamb, and many more. You can visit www.offersontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Well, it's hard to believe, especially for me, that New York Times bestselling author Catherine Neville's The Eight came out 20 years ago and was, in fact, the first hardcover that Ballantine Books produced. It was an international bestseller. It's still on everyone's favorite reads list. And until recently, she hadn't written a sequel, but tonight she will tell us about the sequel called The Fire. And it's a continuation of the game that has the power to change the world. Catherine Neville has also written A Calculated Risk, The Magic Circle. And we have all those books in back over there on the bookshelf facing the stairs. It really was her legacy that paved the way for books like The Da Vinci Code, The Rule of Four. So without any further ado, please welcome Catherine Neville.
I am so thrilled to be here. As you all probably know, I've lived a lot of my life in Colorado. And in fact, one of the opening scenes of this book, The Fire, is set in Four Corners around Mesa Verde. So it was very exciting for me to write it. Let me say, I just need a little show of hands of how many people here have actually read The Eight. Oh, my God, everybody. Who hasn't? Okay, one person. Three people haven't. So I'll say a little bit about The Eight, but not a lot. The reason this book is so important, The Fire, and I think you all probably know by now that this is the 2008 is the 20th anniversary of my first published book, The Eight. But what most people don't know is that this is also the 20th anniversary of the first hardback book that Ballantine ever published, which is The Eight. Ian Ballantine was a sort of legend in his own time, and he had founded three of the four big paperback houses in the world. There were no paperbacks before Ian's time. And about 1986 or something, the head of Ballantine at that time, Susan Peterson, she's now CEO of Viking Putnam Penguin, so she's really a person who has made a lot of wise decisions in her career. She decided she wanted to publish a line of hardback books. And so she said to the editor-in-chief and the head of marketing and so forth, I want you to go out and find the weirdest, strangest, most unusual book you can possibly find for our first book. Because at that time, the bookstores were divided, I think some of you will remember, into like literature on this side, fiction on that side. If you wrote horror or mystery or anything like that, it was in the back of the store, sci-fi. And if you wrote, romance or something like that, it would probably be in the 7-Eleven or the supermarket. And so now all of that has changed, but it changed very slowly. But when I was quite young in the 50s, the books I loved to read were these swashbuckling pirate books by Raphael Sabatini, like Captain Blood and the Seahawk and Scaramouche. And the books that I like the best, well, I'll say that in a moment. At any rate, all these people like Publishers Weekly have been giving me credit for having founded this entire genre of book, whatever it may be called. But when The Eight first came out in 1988, just before it came out, Publishers Weekly called my publisher and said, we would like to do a full-page interview with Catherine. They had never done one of these full-page in-depth interviews with a completely unpublished and unknown author before. So they sent me clippings. I was over in Austria, living in Austria, and they sent me these clippings and saying, you know, these are the most recent people that we had that we have interviewed, and it was Anne Rice and Arthur Miller. So we had no idea what we were doing, and then right after the book came out in January, my first media interview was on the Today Show with Jane Pauley. And so everyone was really confused about it. And the book, The Eight, got reviewed by, like, Locus Magazine as a science fiction book. It got reviewed as history, mystery, magic, all these other categories. And it got, I think, I received an award from Romantic Times as the best historic romance. I was receiving lots of awards for things, but if you put all the reviews together, you couldn't tell what on earth the book was about. And then the papers started calling me the female Umberto Eco and the female Alexander Dumas and the female Steven Spielberg. I think the Washington Post said it was a feminist Raiders of the Lost Ark or something. And everyone was really confused about it. And there was no genre. But after all this time, and now people have surfaced, like Dan, whatever his name is, you know, who wrote this book about... I'm joking. No, but, you know, all these, the guys, as I call them, have been writing a lot of these books. But I have known all along, since I was very, very young, what kind of book it was that I was writing. And it's actually the oldest form of literature that we have in the world, and it's called a quest novel. So I'm very, and you know, like Parsifal was after the Holy Grail and Jason was after the Golden Fleece, and I'm always saying that Odysseus and Dorothy of Oz were looking for home in different ways. But the oldest one, of course, that was in print was called the Gilgamesh, and Gilgamesh was the king of Sumer in Mesopotamia, and he was looking for the elixir of life. So even though we give a lot of credit to someone like me or like all of the guys who are writing this field now, I think a person who deserves huge success for uncorking this kind of novel is the woman who's gotten, and I try to give her credit wherever I can, tens of millions of children all over the world to read 700-page books. And those 700-page books, they not only read them, but they retain what they read. They can tell you in Harry Potter series what book the spider was in and what book the unicorn was in. So they have this incredible retention, and the books she's writing are quest novels. That's it. So I was very, very proud when The Fire came out that on the copyright page where they put where you should shelve the book in the bookstore, they put number one, they put quest expeditions. I thought, this is great. Now we're going to have a shelf in the bookstore that says quest novels. People will know where to find my books finally. Oh, I hope so. So anyway, I know that there are going to be a lot of questions here. So what I'm going to try to do is very, very briefly just summarize a few things that happened while I was writing this book, because as you know, it took 20 years for me to do the sequel to The Eight, and everyone's been asking over and over, why did it take 20 years? It was July 17th of 1992. I remember the date for a reason. And I was on a 16-hour train trip from Switzerland to Prague. I had been doing research at Erinos in Switzerland for a few weeks, which is the big Jung Center right on Lago Maggiore. And Carl, my husband, was doing research along with me, but he was doing psychology research. And I was looking into all the mythology and things. And the last day we were there, and the next morning at 5 a.m., we had to crawl up this muddy bank to get out of Erinos. And there's a little narrow, skinny road that where cars can't stop at all, where the taxi was coming to pick us up to take us to the train. So we had to be standing there and jump over this little wall. Anyway, the afternoon before, we're having lunch on Lago Maggiore out in the bright sunshine, and we go in the back of the restaurant to look for the powder room. And they had all these lights that turn themselves off for energy efficiency. Not a great idea from my viewpoint after what happened. And I had this serious accident. I I thought I was, we were running up and down these darkened halls, and I finally said, well, it must be this hall over here. So I fly into space. It wasn't a hall, it was a stairwell. So I'm out flying down the stairs head first. And I knew, I mean, I'd fallen down so many mountains here in Colorado skiing that I knew the proper way to fall, you know, that you get your head, ribs and head protected. And I'm saying to myself, Carl's a brain scientist. And I kept thinking to myself as I'm flying through space, you know, at least I travel with my own brain surgeon if I hit incorrectly. So anyway, I landed about halfway down and I skidded and bounced to the bottom and everything was torn off of me. My stockings and my earrings were squashed. And so Carl said, well, nothing is broken when he got down and checked me out. But he said, you know, you can't go 16 hours on a train tomorrow just sitting in one place. You've got to keep moving. So I kept walking up and down through all the cars of the train for 16 hours until we got to Prague. And that's when I got the idea of how to do the sequel to The Eight. I realized that I could have, I couldn't read anything. I couldn't really eat much. And I realized that I could have the children of the previous characters who, and after all, the book, The Eight, was set in 1973, and this was 1992, so they could have had children by then, grown children. And I thought, well, you know, the children of the characters could suddenly be thrown into the game and have, like, no idea what was going on. And characters from the previous book, from the historic and modern chapters, could show up and just reveal to them, because they were in the same scenes, like Lily Rad, the great grandmaster, who becomes the aunt of young Alexandra, the character in the sequel. She had been in the same scenes in the desert with Kat, Alexandra's mother. She had actually met Solarin at the same time in New York at the Metropolitan Club as Kat had met him, and then Kat goes on and falls in love with him and marries him and has a daughter with him. But Lily saw all these scenes from her own point of view. So I thought this was a great way to sort of turn the book 90 degrees so that you're looking at the same scenes but from a completely different perspective, so it sort of fleshes out all of these scenes. So I was really impressed with myself that I did. And the reason I remember the date is we stepped off the train in Prague and learned that they had just voted that day to dissolve the entire country of Czechoslovakia. So July 17th. So, and our host was Ivan Havel, who is the brother of Václav, who had been the president of the former Czechoslovakia. I got off the train and everybody was musing and we were going to these meetings that we were supposed to attend. And the first thing I did was I said, I need to go to the post office. This is the way novelist minds think, you know. Everyone went, why do you have to go to the post office? And I got to the post office and I bought all the stamps. There were no more stamps. There would be no more Czechoslovakian stamps. So I have this big collection of fabulous stamps of Czechoslovakia. I mean, that sort of shows you the kind of strange serendipity that goes on in our minds. So anyway, I knew how to do it. And I'm going to cut forward because there were so many things that happened that prevented me from writing this book. It was like yanking tablecloths out from under all the silverware. I had always had the experience of having the whole idea of the book, the characters, the plot, the everything, and books would just fall off the shelf of the library open to the right page. I was trying to figure out in The Eight, you know, where was Napoleon on such and such a day when my heroine was about to head to this abbey during the terror so she could get a pass out of France and go to Corsica. So this book falls off the shelf, and I was sitting on the floor of the Mechanics Institute Library in San Francisco, my private library I belonged to. They have the biggest rare chess book collection in America. And this book falls open in knees or something, and it says, on such and such an hour of such and such a day, Napoleon had taken leave from the army to go pick up his little sister Maria Elisa at the same abbey so he could escort her home to Corsica. So I called my editor-in-chief and said, Napoleon just dropped into my book one chapter early. He's going to the same monastery, and then he's going to Corsica so he can accompany my heroine to Corsica. And he said, ooh, that's really spooky. So But I did it, and that really changed a lot of the... But it took 5 weeks. I was under deadline and everything. So that kept happening during the writing of The Fire. Just as one example, what finally happened, the last sort of roadblock that was thrown up was when this plane... flew into the Pentagon right across the river from my apartment in Washington, D.C. And I knew about the Twin Towers because 9 minutes earlier or whatever, we had been, we were supposed to go on September 12th to Spain. And we had gone across the street. I had canceled the trip, but we were going across the street to the travel agents to find out what the seat assignment was for him. And we saw our travel agent running down the street with this little TV on his shoulders. He said, "Oh, it's terrible. A plane has just hit the World Trade Center." So we went inside, and Carl went to get his seat assignments, and he plugs in the TV, and he said, "Look, there it is, an instant replay. The plane is flying right into the tower, and, you know, it's hitting the tower." And I'm saying, why do they always build these tall, high-rise buildings right near flight plans? You know, it's so dangerous, and thinking it's an accident. And then I said, "Well, what's that plume of smoke coming out of that other tower over there?" And the voiceover said, "A second plane has just hit the second tower." So all the phones in D.C. and Virginia were jammed. So we walked home about four blocks to our house in our tiny little town, and we unlocked the door, and the radio was on. We always left it on for our little bird, Tootie, who liked to listen to classical music. I just heard from a person who is a... who has a big radio program in California, that they love it when people leave radios on for their pets because they get ratings for that. So our bird must have gotten them a lot of ratings. So anyway, they said, "We interrupt this classical music program because a third plane has just hit the Pentagon." You know, and Carl is like, "Are we at war with someone?" And the first thing out of my mouth was, "I am not writing the book that I thought I was writing, because you can't write a sequel to a book that's about, you know, OPEC and oil and energy and Islam and Arabs in the Middle East, and when it's actually happening again." And we forget that in 1973, when I was living in North Africa and the OPEC embargo happened, there were hijackings weekly. I mean, they were bringing planes down in Algiers, and the airport would be closed every couple of weeks, you know, trying to get the hostages off, and there were wars going on and bombings going on everywhere. So this was just like one, I knew it was just one higher curve of the spiral, and I knew I couldn't write a book when the events that were supposed to be in the book were actually happening. So I put the book in the drawer that time for a couple of years, and then here's the great, one of the great serendipity things. I get this email from a reader saying, "Oh, Miss Neville, I just read your book while I was over in Kuwait, when I was stationed over there." And I get all these letters from, servicemen and women all the time. And he said, "I was so inspired to master chess that I really worked very hard at it. And for a couple of years, I've really, really worked to, you know, become an expert at chess. And I learned that you live near Washington, D.C. or in D.C. And I would really like to invite you, I'd like to host you for a private lunch or a private dinner and a tour of the private bunkers and tunnels underneath United States Treasury." And it's signed the Chief of Staff of the U.S. Treasury. So I'm thinking, right, this is an email, right? it was like, you know, 22 years in data processing security. And I'm, you know, and all you have to do is put your bank account number in here, I'm sure. And, you know, this lady is saying, it said one night when I was telling this story, and she said, "You too may restore a Nigerian prince to his rightful throne." So I just wrote a polite letter and said, "Thank you very much. I'm glad you're interested in my work. I'm going to, you know, I'm very pleased by it and honored." And it sounds really fascinating, but I'm not writing right now about Treasury or anything financial. I'm actually writing an entire book about something completely different. So 3 months later, I get another email saying, "So when can we set up that lunch down here at Treasury?" And I had, as chance will have it, I just received a fantastic assignment to appear on a panel with all these really prestigious authors in New York, and the panel was all about financial thrillers. And I thought, well, I haven't written a financial thriller since Calculated Risk 20 years ago or something. And I didn't know anything new, so I thought, well, maybe I should go down to Treasury and see if there's anything new I can learn about. So I go down to Treasury. I called first, and I said, I called his assistant. Well, actually, by then, I'd looked him up in the almanac and found out he really is chief of staff of the U.S. Treasury. And in fact, he's the youngest chief of staff they've ever had. So I called up his assistant and said, I can set up the lunch, but I have to set it up right away before I go to, you know, hit the road for New York. And she said, oh, I'll set it up immediately. All we need is your Social Security number. So I didn't go right away. Now, they do need it for Secret Service clearance and everything. So finally, I decided I really must go, because it was like my book was, you know, it was like I had a deadline. I already had a contract with my publisher. I was 3/4 of the way through with the book. But it kept nagging at me that maybe I should really go. So finally, I went down to Treasury. I got to see Secretary Paulson's office, you know, he's a big environmentalist, and he had pictures of all the raptors in the wild on his walls, and I got to meet everybody, and this is before our current crisis, well before. And so we all had lunch, a bunch of us had lunch, and then everybody left, and he's sitting there, the chief is sitting there alone with me in the dining room at Treasury, looking out over the, you know, gardens and stuff. And I said, so how did you happen to learn to master chess when you were in Kuwait? And he said, oh, no, I didn't learn to master chess in Kuwait. I read your book when I was in Kuwait. He said, I learned to master chess in Baghdad. I was the second person into Baghdad right after the war began. And I went, well, who was the first person? And he said, my boss, Tommy Franks. And I went, because I thought he looked pretty young to be the second in whatever to Tommy Franks. And I said, well, how did you get that job? And he said, well, actually, I was just loaned to him by my real boss, Condoleezza Rice. So it turns out he really has been written up in all these books and everything. And so he ended up, and I said, you know, this is so bizarre, because I came down here to find out about Treasury, but I'm having all these problems with my book, because I don't really know what it is my book wants me to do. And I realized all of a sudden, I'm not here to learn about Treasury. I'm here to learn about Baghdad, because, you know, at the very end of the eight, this chess set that I invented and imagined, it's mentioned briefly that it was created in 775 AD by Al-Jabir ibn Hayyan, who really was a real person, who is the father of Islamic alchemy and had written a number of great books. And it was invented in what was then the brand new city of Baghdad that had just been created. So I said, you know, the chess set is from Baghdad. Now, we always call it the chess set that belonged to Charlemagne, but it was really invented in Baghdad. And so this is what my book wanted me to do, learn about Baghdad. And he said, the chief said, I know, that's why I thought you'd really want to talk to me. So he ended up Googling all these incredible things that he'd seen. I mean, he'd actually had a missile land in the swimming pool of the house that they had assigned to him. And so he was Googling these things like the hands of Saddam Hussein with the big swords. And he said, you know, you can walk up inside of them in stairs, and you could hide some pieces of the Monk Land Service in there. And he was coming up with these great ideas. But it was so amazingly helpful. So I knew, had I written the book when I thought of it in 1992, none of this had happened. The book, you know, had I written it right before 2001 when the plane hit the Pentagon, it hadn't happened yet. And I think the book really was holding itself off in a way until the events happened that it was supposed to be about, you know, which really had brought it back to, why was the chess set, who cares about Charlemagne, you know, why was the chess set invented in Baghdad? What did it have to do with that? And it turns out what it had to do with it was, that was the beginning of the schism between Sunni and Shia Islam. And the guy who invented the chess set in my imagination happened to be a Sufi who was in the middle of all that soup. So that's just one example of the kinds of serendipity that happened. It happened so often, writing The Fire, that actually my editor, I was 5 months late with the book, and my editor was actually editing right behind me. He was getting stuff every single day from me. And I call him after he'd gotten the stuff and read it, and I'd say, you're never going to believe what just happened. And something new had happened that I'd just written about, and he'd say, get out of here. You know, he's very young. younger than the chief, yeah. But anyway, he was great. And so he kept pushing me, you know, to put all this stuff as it was happening. I'd never before written a book where I had to write about events that were happening around me, but really, you know, just the moment I wrote them, we discovered it either had happened or it was happening right now. So it was just a phenomenal experience, and I'm so relieved and thrilled that I got to do it, because it would have been just another sequel to another book that everybody loved. I also had a lot of reservations, and then I'm going to pause for a moment and ask for questions. I had a lot of reservations about writing the book about, first of all, just writing a sequel to The Eight. I was terrified. You know, people, The Eight is in 37 languages. It's been a bestseller in every language. It was voted in Spain about 5 years ago. El País, the journal, did a national survey, and it was voted one of the top 10 books in history. And it's, you know, people really love it. And I was afraid, I call it a Stephen King moment. You know, I was afraid I was going to have a fan somewhere who would say, I'll break your kneecaps, you did this character wrong or something, you know. And I also was afraid to do it about Washington, D.C., even though I've lived there ever since I left San Francisco 20 years ago, because Dan, whatever his name is, had said he was doing his next book on Freemasons in Washington, D.C., and so there was this huge cottage industry of books about, you know, Freemasons in D.C. and so forth, and I just didn't want to look like I was copying anyone. But then I realized I knew places in D.C., that even people who were born and raised there didn't know about. So I set the entire modern part of the book in 1 week of 2003, the first week of April when we went into Baghdad, and mainly in Washington, D.C. And I actually threw the party there, and the place, I'll tell that story later when I know someone will ask a question about it, but it's a place that wasn't on the map. When they went to take my picture from my website and the photographer went, I insisted that we go down into Georgetown on the river near Key Bridge where the book takes place and take pictures. And when we parked our car along Key Park, which is a tiny little park like this big, the car parked right in front of us was the GPS car. I mean, they were actually writing down the addresses in this alley because it wasn't on any map of D.C. So I went, great, you know, I wrote a book. No one can copy this because no one even knew where the place was. So thanks very much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fodo, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for Peter Greenberg, Wally Lamb, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on November 18th, 2008.